Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The main team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Condor223.
The DS.
Could you type that in for me, please, so I don't forget it? I've got like a memory like a goldfish.
What do you have a memory like, Jim?
A goldfish.
Yeah, they don't remember things for like 8 seconds.
Yeah.
What kind of memory do you have, Jim?
It's like a goldfish.
Exactly.
Welcome to Polycast number 92. I'm one of your many guest hosts today, Jim the DS Adams. With me today I have regular Daniel Quick.
Spring is in the air.
Another regular Malakua, or Makalua as she likes to be called.
I guess I could use some Kahlua right now.
We have the infamous, the me and team.
Just think of me as Civ 2's military advisor.
Another guest host, Gloria Carson, also known as Nolan.
Hello.
And last but not least, our very own Lisa Vang, also known as QNL.
Spring is in the water. In forum talk, we discuss Moai statues, what the hell, and would you buy Civilization V if only offered on Steam?
From the Vault, gaming standards and attack in multiplayer. Under the miscellaneous heading, Golden Ages, use and length.
In the Senate, we discuss scientific method in the Great Library and a little bit of lesson on economics of opportunity cost. And phalanxes are awesome, or at least they really were in vanilla.
And then from the vault once more, Axeman versus a chariot rush and capitulation mechanics.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
The Moai statues.
I see the link, Manfred asking to have them as a world wonder, but I see they're pretty useful at times if you get stuck by the RNG and you really need some hammers in a good place, you can choose where to put it. I think it's a great equalizer.
Yeah, the original poster makes the claim that it's, you know, pretty far-fetched, especially to claim that having a bunch of stoneheads in the ocean somehow increases productivity of that ocean. But I don't know. I just keep on thinking back to, like, pyramids giving granaries in every city in Civ 3. That's probably one of the more ridiculous ones I've seen. Moai statues don't seem that bad. They could ostensibly increase productivity somehow, right?
The realism argument, I mean, you kind of touched on that with regards to pyramids in Civ 3, but Mario Greymist went through quite a few of the ancient wonders and pointed out the lack of logical connection between what it is and what benefit it gives you. I think my favorite is like the Oracle, a crazy lady in a cave that teaches me metal casting in one turn.
That's
the Kremlin reducing costs, too. I mean, come on. Now, he does say later on, granted, we have Scotland Yard and the Globe Theatre and Oxford University all as national wonders when the real world only has one of them, but they basically represent a generic great theatre or great university which all civs could have. And so then Starman Beta kind of pounced on that and says, like, well, you answered your own question. The Moai statues can represent generic big stone statues of dudes that have been built in pretty much any human culture with access to stone. Now, of course, you don't actually have to have access to stone in order to build this, but it does double your production of it. For those listening wondering, what's this now? Your water tiles get plus one hammer, plus four culture, and costs 250 hammers to build, and you can start building it after you require the sailing technology.
I would just like to point out that if you don't have stone, it's probably not a good idea to build them. The returns on it are too low. Like, in a city that doesn't have a lot of hammers, building the statues takes forever. It's not like the city is a hammer powerhouse once you complete it. Maybe with the Dutch you can get one good, mostly water tile city this way. But for the most part, even if every single tile in your fat crosses coast or ocean, it's still only going to be 20 hammers base, which isn't impressive. But usually it's more like 10, and you know, you're probably not even going to be working all of them. So it's definitely a national wonder you can pass on, unless you're just, you're industrious or something, and you're building in a bunch of cities so that when you do finally complete it somewhere, you get a bunch of gold. But for the most part, it's very situational, and I wouldn't recommend it without stone.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I definitely had the experience where I just had a city that's on one tile, and God, there's nothing I can make with the city except just there to claim territory. And so I'll just build Moai statues because I don't want to build it anywhere else. And they'll be done with them at like 1900 or something.
Well, little fishing villages can at least come fall back on either the whip or universal suffrage to rush by. If you can't do either of those, your best bet's probably just running a couple specialists or something.
I don't build them until I have most of the tiles active anyway, so they don't take as long when I have the population for it.
I see it as kind of a consolation prize or a last ditch. You've got to have something here. I mean, at least you've got a minimum of 10 or 20 hammers here in the city. If you are building what I call the water economy, where most of your cities are getting their money because they're coastal and you rely on the Great Lighthouse and harbors and stuff like that, you know, it turns a mediocre city into a less mediocre city.
If you have a location for a city that you can protect that's buffered away from potential attack, even if you don't have stone, it's a really long-term investment. You're trying to fill in the space because you're worried that the AI might actually go forward, or you want to have kind of like a quote-unquote sleeper city, so long as the city has sufficient food in it so it could take benefit of most, if not all, of your water tiles to get that increased hammer production, then go for it. But yeah, it is very situational. It's not something that would be an immediate priority, especially without stone. And as has also been said, you may be better off, at least in order to build the Moai statues, that you could be running some great people in there. Maybe forge would take a while, but I suppose if you really wanted to get like a great engineer or something in there so that you could build the Moai statues more quickly. But I'll end up building it in almost every game, but it's not an immediate priority, depending upon, as I said, you know, circumstances. Phil mentioned industrious. If you've got stone, that moves the priority up. I often start building it in a city, and then it's just kind of a later game. Oh, I forgot I was building that there, and that's done? Oh, great, that's nice. But the original poster's suggestion why he thinks it should be, as it is anyway, why it should be a world wonder, though, it's not that spectacular.
Well, I don't know why it should be a world wonder, but if it was, somebody suggested giving the effect to all your cities. Now, I certainly miss the oil platform and its effect. You know, I built one every time, and I like playing as the Dutch and getting that dike so that my water tiles are actually useful. It really helps with the quote-unquote water economy. So if they had something, not necessarily the Moai statues, but some wonder that made all the water tiles in your civilization productive. Great Lighthouse gives you an extra couple trade routes. You have the Colossus gives you an extra coin.
Colossus doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, I think people have kind of leveled the criticism against Civ that it's pretty Eurocentric, and I feel like the Moai statues are certainly pretty deserving of the title World Wonder, and feel free to disagree with me, but they are pretty damn significant, I think.
Well, if we're going to move it to a world wonder, then I think the benefits that the Moai statues are giving you needs to reflect that.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you move it to a world wonder, it'd have to be stronger, because otherwise no one would bother with it. But if it had the effect of doing that to every city, then suddenly it's one of the stronger wonders, especially better than Colossus.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting. Although I don't think it would be too rigged, actually. Or maybe it would be, but only on some maps, and that's why they didn't do it.
Would you buy Civilization V if only offered on Steam? I think we could even abstract that to just a more general. Would you buy if it was only offered as a direct download as opposed to a physical boxed copy? But in this thread on a poll from started by Orden, so what's winning right now is I would prefer something else, but if Steam is the only option, I will buy it.
I don't mind Steam. I like Steam. I like Steam too much, apparently, from all the games I've got that I haven't played yet.
I don't know. Can I have my cake and eat it, too? Can I purchase it as a direct download and then, as an option, have a boxed copy shipped to me? I actually do like having the boxed copy. I mean, yes, you could take the direct download and then you could burn it yourself if that was allowed, and then you could have your own physical copy, but I would actually like a boxed copy sent to me. Well, I don't know if I'm old school or what it is, but I like the option of having both. I don't see why it needs to be one or the other. If you want to charge me a little for it, because it's kind of that nostalgia, having it sit on the shelf, have it so that your place doesn't look too empty because you're too busy playing games to have any furnishings or whatever in your house, then, you know, it's... Oh, wait, I might be revealing too much. I will I'll go on to somebody else. Where's your food?
I mean, I did the same thing. I bought the Boss copy when it first came out, but then I moved and I didn't have Civ 4, and I think I just kind of got the urge to play it again. And, oh, lo and behold, it was on Steam. So I love Steam. It's my friend. Also, I mean, the nice thing about Steam is that you can go to computers and download it. You just need to download it, and it's not a big deal at all.
It's my understanding that when they release a patch for a game, they have to release a custom patch for Steam.
Yes.
And it usually takes them longer to release that, and that's part of the reason why I have always avoided it.
I agree. One could make the argument that, well, once that patch comes out, we'll let those physical copy people, quote-unquote, test it even further in the wild, and then by the time it comes to us, then we know that if it was a one-step-forward, two-step-back thing, then it's already been addressed. But still, I think Civ patch releases, for the most part, have not had this troubled history of that kind of one-step-forward, two-step-back sort of thing, at least recently.
A Steam copy is good for Access Economy, too. Save some quite a bit, and they get instant availability to everybody. I remember when it was a bear, people were going, well, when is it going to be put out in UK, and when are they going to publish it here or there? And at least everybody has the option to start at the same time and wait for the box copy to hit the market.
This is a Vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes, but have found relevance again later.
From episode 71 with Dan Q, Makalua, Peach Rocks, the DS, and the Mian team.
I just feel the standard has dropped lately. Not lately, but over the past few years. With a few exceptions, I feel it stands strong. That may be me.
I think that might just be, of course, the gaming community as a whole has grown quite a bit in recent years. And also you have a lot more games based off of movies and things like that. And let's be honest, most games that are produced, they're just capitalizing on the movie's popularity. Rare are they actually good. So you get a lot of that stuff, and you have a lot of newer gamers who, you know, either they don't know any better or they don't care or whatever.
Gaming has suddenly become mainstream, which, as much as we don't want it to, I mean, well, we want it to in a sense because we get more games, but it also means that they have to cater to tastes other than us who have been playing for a long time. They have to keep making money. They have to attract the people who don't play games as much and maybe don't have as high a standard.
It's not about standards. It's just really, it's as Philip said, if they don't have to try, why should they?
I agree with that.
If you have a good quality product, you're going to get a better reputation, you're going to do better long term or whatever. But at times they have crazy deadlines, because you know, you want to get the game out, you know, by around
maybe
it comes out, or you know, maybe you got budget problems all of a sudden or whatever. And there's so many things, not just with gaming industry specifically, but just with businesses in general. If something goes wrong, it's easy to see, because you can look at a game production as like as a project that you have to manage. And all kinds of things can go wrong. I don't know a lot about programming, but I've heard enough to realize something could go wrong that could affect the quality of the game if you don't have enough staff or budget to fix it in time.
On the one hand, I think there are people that like to play games where they create people and teach them how to go to the bathroom, and they're fine with that. And then there are other people who prefer something more deep, but I also recognize that by the same token that the former kinds are the ones that have a greater mass appeal, and thanks to the income that they generate, perhaps that the games that we hear for more to play may actually end up seeing the light of day. So they're a necessary evil.
The term you're looking for is cash cow, Dan. It is hard not to make a game of the same thing if you know it's just going to make you squidoodles of money.
I guess giving people Sims to take care of is better than giving them actual two-year-olds to take care of.
Yeah.
Or even fish or some other animal. We can avoid the animal cruelty, too. If you can make it with The Sims, then we'll upgrade you to fish. With fish, then we can move up to some small rodents. And then maybe, just maybe, we could get to small mammals. And then maybe, just maybe, we could talk about children. Maybe. From episode 80 with Tank Q, Makalua, the V and Team, Lord Parkin, and Pirate.
Probably the biggest problem with attacking in multiplayer is post-construction. You're just getting wailed on by siege.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to position yourself so you don't just get massacred by siege, because they have the movement initiative with it no matter what. The siege only moves one square per turn on any terrain in enemy territory. So if you're bringing siege and they have siege, they're always going to have initiative.
Yeah.
Or if you're the defender, you get the initiative then and screw their army over.
It's also kind of funny when you have those situations where you both in turn right next to each other and you're sort of both furiously clicking on them, trying to be the one who gets off the attack as soon as the turn begins.
Yeah. This is why I don't like GameSpy so much. I've played my share of games on it, and it's okay, but it's complete blitz. Who can click fastest, and it really makes 7 to more of a real-time strategy than a turn-based strategy.
Yeah.
In some ways. And that's kind of why I much prefer large-scale DVM pit boss games, because then you have a really long format game, and you have a lot of time to think about it. And also the really fun thing I find is that half the game is outside the game, and conducting diplomacy with other people.
See, to me, there's just too much time between turns there, and I lose interest because, yeah, I'm one of those players who'll play a game and stuff for 3 hours on average.
Yeah, I'm aware, yeah.
GameSpy plays to my strengths because these blazing turn timers, and for everyone else or for a lot of other players, it's actually forcing them to make concessions on their gameplay, whereas with me, I could play single player with the blazing turn timer. So, yeah, that's an advantage for me, but I'm amazed that I can click faster than some people online on occasion because I have one of the worst computers that can actually run Civ. I guess people aren't playing with their minimized tabs or something, or I'm actually able to steal a worker off of a double move when I'm not really even trying for a double move. Like, my skirmisher was sitting there next to their worker for 30 seconds before the turn ended, and at the start of the next turn, I'm still able to take the worker with one of the worst computers possible. I mean, maybe they have a bad connection or something.
It'll be the ping of your connection that affects that more than your actual computer.
I guess, but it still feels like it took me like 3 seconds to actually make the move. It's still not the thing. Because, you know, my computer is slow enough that my turns will take longer to load than other people's. I noticed this in our games quite frequently.
I'll do the whole thing with Mausoleum of Solos and build that before I have any Golden Ages, and then build the Taj Mahal so I get 3 Golden Ages for 3 great people.
The only problem is getting it. Actually getting it is difficult because the AI loves calendar. You know, once the AI has calendar, they'll all take pot shots at it, so it's hard to get it. But if you do get it, it's worth it. A lot of space racers will pick it up.
I definitely like it myself, but of late, I've been kind of limiting myself to, I don't want to use more than 2 great people for a golden age, because it's hard to get the guys, and then half the point for me of having a golden age is to get more great people. So I don't generally get a 3 people golden age anymore. I don't really do that.
I only use 3-person golden ages if I'm going for space. Because if you're that late in the game, the benefits of settling it are really low because the game's almost over. Obviously, bulbing does almost nothing. Yeah, you don't have a lot of options. And if you're that close to space, even founding a corporation, by the time you get a corporation set up, you'll probably launch the ship. So the only thing that can really speed up the production of ship parts then is a golden age. So of course you run one. By then, since you have enough tiles, the effects are really, really huge too. That's when golden age are at their strongest, and I would actually burn 3 on it. Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
actually don't think that Polaris are awesome. They're all right.
They're good on the offensive because you don't have to build spears to counter chariots, but I was never, like, greatly impressed by them. They're not bad. You don't lose anything for having them as a unique unit. They fill their niche decently. I mean, chariot horse is a reasonably common strategic resource. I think it's twice as common as metal, so there's a good chance that, yeah, I'll have a couple chariots to hit you. So it's not terrible. It just doesn't have a huge amount of rush value over the basic unit. A great unit? No way. And you get things like vultures, immortals, war chariots, that kind of stuff is way better than base unit they're replacing.
Practically in-game, just for people who are listening, we're talking about the Phalanx that's replacing the Axemen unit, and the difference is that Phalanx is getting plus 100% defense versus chariot. We want to talk about an Axemen unit replacement that would be better, the vulture, not the dog soldier.
Dog soldier is great defensively, but you're not attacking anyone with it. It's probably better than the vulture in multiplayer, just because the vulture is reasonably easy to counter, whereas the dog soldier has choking options, and it counters any of those melee-based rushes. But I would argue that the vanilla phalanx was better, a lot better. It could hold up reasonably well to knights, so you had an anti-mounted counter for the first half of the game, really, available at hunting and bronzeworking. So even though it wouldn't serve as strongly as an offensive unit, as they do in Beyond the Sword, they were still better because they were more consistently useful. Very useful in some situations. The Beyond the Sword version, I'm just not impressed with it. I mean, it's alright, but it's not great. It's not even near great.
I guess for those actually not playing with Beyond the Sword, then it would be replacing your Spearman and not your Axeman.
Yes. In that case, I would push it a little higher. I mean, it's still probably not like a top 5 unique unit, but yeah, it might be in the top 10 then. Just because of its defensive abilities against all mounted until, like, cavalry. Because vanilla and warlords didn't have cuirassiers. So literally, like, it would beat every mounted unit in the game on a cost basis easily, except for cavalry. That's just crazy.
I forgot to acknowledge that thread was started by Alex the Great.
He also tagged it as soup for vanilla, so.
Oh, that hadn't registered with me. Okay, so that does put it in better context.
I didn't realize that at first, because, I mean, just a bonus against chariots, like, will be. But what Bill said about the vanilla is a lot more appropriate.
Scientific method and great library. Thread started by Culture Bomb. And the one dilemma I often have is that if I have the great library, I never know whether to delay getting scientific method to preserve the free scientists and also any research generated by monasteries. Daniel aside, and also any hammers generated by the apostolic palace from the monasteries. End aside. But his three options, Culture Bomb sees, is delay SI as long as possible to get the maximum benefit of the free scientists. Yep. Get scientific method in the normal course of events by trading or teching whenever I feel like I need to progress to one of the techs that require it. Or beeline scientific method as quickly as possible with the aim of either getting to physics first to the free grade scientist, or communism for the free grade spy, and the chance of building the Kremlin. In this case, the Great Library has done its job. If it has helped you get to scientific method quicker, it will also probably be possible to trade it to around the other civs for useful techs. However, this is probably only possible if you arrive at the stage of the game with a tech lead or at least parity. So, just an overview, scientific method, 2400 beaker costs, it obsoletes the Great Library along with the Temple of Artemis and the Parthenon, and the monasteries, if you have any. Great Library, 350 hammers, plus 8 culture, plus 2 free scientists, and of course the city is more likely to generate a great scientist.
Okay, I have to say this right away. The word free was used in that thread like a bajillion times, and not once was it accurate, and that really irks me when I hear discussion about Civ strategy in general. It isn't just Civ strategy, but that's the topic we're on. Completely loses out on the concept of opportunity cost, and it just bothers me. And if you're being blocked from biology or communism or physics to a lesser extent, they aren't free, great scientists, and neither are they free when you spent the hammers to get them. Not that it isn't a good investment, but it isn't free.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Exactly. Matters a whole lot in Civ, and failing to get that concept has hurt people. I've seen it many times. As for scientific method itself, obviously the stronger your distribution of wonders and the more you're relying upon your monasteries, the less likely you are to want to tech that. There's how important you are to things beyond it. If you're going heavy on workshops or going heavy on farms, you'll want to go there sooner than if you're going heavy on cottages, because you'll be conferred more benefits. So really, it's a judgment call, but on the bright side, you can pretty readily calculate how much you're losing in terms of your monastery and wonders benefits versus what you'll get once you reach a tech that's beyond scientific method. Now, as for its trade value, AIs tend to prioritize it a little bit more heavily than other things, so it's not a very viable trading tech. If you're very fast, you can trade it, but AIs love it, so it's only going for aesthetics or something like that. You can bulb it with a great scientist. If you're pushing to take something like biology or communism from liberalism, you might want to bulb it with a great scientist, but it itself isn't a great trading technology. Biology is, though, by the way.
Yes, go bio. I know that you're not a huge fan of religion, so you don't actually tend to delay it very long, do you?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I use religion extensively. I'm not a fan of founding an early religion because the returns you get for it are not worth what you're giving up to get it. But in terms of using in a religion that the AI spreads, or if I don't have that, possibly bulbing philosophy, I'll use religion. I'll use it happily. And some of the wonders are actually easy to pick up, and especially Sankor, which is on the path to liberalism. So a reasonable amount of the time, having the benefits of two of the three religious wonders, because Apostolic Palace applies to anybody who just builds buildings, and then I have Sankor, and then it's significant. Again, it depends on what my tile improvement choices are, and how far along I am in the game, and whether or not I want to use state property, because if state property is critical, I can't put it off. But if I'm relying heavily on monasteries for hammers or beakers or whatever, I might go, say, rifling first, and then come back for state property after that so that I can pay for the cities I captured. It's just situational. It's not something where you can just say, okay, you can always do this in this situation or whatever.
I would say that if you're relying really heavily on monasteries, I don't know anybody who, on the town might be doing that, but if you are relying pretty heavily on monasteries, then it can be prudent to put scientific method off.
Monasteries on a hammer conversion basis are as good as observatories because they're cheaper than observatories, and that's only that component. So if you have the benefits of Sankor or Apostolic Palace or Spiral Minaret, they become one of your better investments pretty quickly. If you have two of them, they're like the first thing you'd want to build after a granary in new cities. If you have a strong science city and you just put missionaries there and you wind up with three or four religions, that could be a very significant multiplier in your bureaucracy capital, for example, to have you know, somewhere between 30 and 50% extra science from the commerce there. So it can be a significant consideration if you're relying on them, and some people do it, even in high levels.
One of the things that I really like about the Great Library and the Temple of Artemis is the free extra people that you get converts into a lot of extra great people points. That's an extra 9 points from building two wonders, plus the points for the wonders themselves. That's 13 points. Now, if you don't mind your people pool being polluted, which a lot of people don't like that, but me, I can put any great person to use. Those extra 13 points, plus if you get the Parthenon, you add that, plus another 50%, so you're at 22 just from three wonders, plus whatever specialist that you go and assign. That's pretty huge, especially early in the game. You can get two or three or four great people out the door before the other guys get their second one.
Sort of.
That's one of the things that I really like about it.
There are ways to come up with lots and lots of great person points without any wonders at all. Most typical is early caste system for scientists, instant 12. But if someone gets their hands on philosophy by bulbing it, then they're running pacifism and they're up to 24. Just running four scientists, and then if you add on top of that national epic, even more. Sometimes you can run more than four specialists in the city, in which case you can quickly pound out ridiculous amounts of scientists in a short period of time. If you aren't running a national epic, you can do that in multiple cities without wonders.
Right.
It's not perfectly efficient, but you can get similar great person points doing that as opposed to building the wonders, and you don't have to divert down that tech path. The big draws for a great library in Temple of Artemis are if you have marble, because then you can get them for a relatively cheap hammer cost.
You can throw the national epic and pacifism at anything and get those points.
Well, yeah, but my point is if you divert for those wonders, then you're delaying the time it takes to get to cast and pacifism oftentimes.
Okay.
there is a benefit to having those wonders, but the actual production of great people in an optimized empire that just goes straight for caste pacifism versus literature will come out ahead, but not by a whole lot, because you get to the multiplier sooner if you go down for pacifism.
I'll have to give that a try.
It can be especially ridiculous with the Golden Age and starvation.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not the only one that starves my people during the Golden Age, huh?
No. And flipping into pacifism and then back out right before the Golden Age ends.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The cost of doing that is not as high.
This is a Vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes but have found relevance again later.
From episode 80 with Dan Q, Makalua, to me and team, Lord Parkin, and Pirate.
I actually think they are, by the way.
Every single time?
No, on average, they're a better unit for rushing than axes.
I've just had too many bad experiences with attacking one archer with four chariots and they all die. It's like, oh.
Yeah, especially on a hill. If I have a choice, which I'd often doubt, if I have copper and horseback nearby, I'll build the X-Men, usually. Or both. But X-Men over chariots.
You can screw with the AI's code for defending itself so badly using mounting.
Yeah.
You can pretty much always hit poorly defended cities, and then for the last ones, you can either dig peace for a little while and just mass up units, or you can choke them, or whatever. It's just hilarious, though. You can almost always get these cities with two or three archers in it.
Yeah.
And Centurions will generally handle that.
It's not even just the AI's fault, I think. Just even playing against a human in multiplayer is just hard to defend against an army that can move around so quickly.
That's true, especially since humans don't get the obscene bonuses that the AI does.
Yeah.
I really screwed someone up with Guerrilla Too Longbows in a recent multiplayer game. Well, I guess it's not that recent anymore. It's like a month ago. But it was so fun. They had like six Guerrilla Longbows. I was threatening one of his cities, and he moved all his troops there. And I could see that there's just an archer or two in Washington. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. I knew I couldn't keep it. I burned it down. But that was enough to get him to quit.
In your own territory, you should be building roads. You have the advantage of movement in your own territory, so when fighting against fast units like chariots or Guerrilla Too Longbows or whatever, you should be able to get to the spots to take them out in time.
Well, the problem is if you can take them out. Part of the advantage of defending in your territory is the defensive bonuses of your tiles. Especially with Guerrilla Too Longbows, it's very difficult to attack them if they actually are in hills or even in forests. Yeah. They have the ability to threaten more than one city at a time, and they also move at the same speed as you before engineering, which causes problems. Because with horse archers or chariots, they can force a battle on the field, so if you don't have the spears to handle it, be a severe problem. Or worse yet, they can just ensure that one of the cities of the two isn't going to be able to protect itself, because they can attack either of them.
Yeah, pretty much.
If it's mounted units or if it's longbows, then you can just stand some units on the hills and stop them from moving on the hills.
Sure, if you can get there in time with the spears, and that's the problem. On turn one of the war, especially with AI, but even against humans, sometimes you're already in a city, or you only have maybe 5-6 turns to build spears, and you still have to pick a city to build them in, because they'll overpower one spear in a city.
Yeah,
you can do it, and if you plan ahead, you can do it well, but that's still one of the more devastating and difficult to defend attacks, is with two move units threatening multiple cities early. And even worse with the naval. If you don't have a good naval defense, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Really threaten a lot of cities.
Really, in multiplayer, though, you should always be expecting that whoever is your neighbor is going to be attacking you at some point. You should be planning ahead for it from the start, so you should be anticipating an attack, and therefore they won't be able to take you by surprise like that.
They'll probably be attacking sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Which unit is the one that they're favoring? Because that is generally difficult to see. Unlike AI, a lot of humans will open their borders and let you go look at their stacks. Although I always enjoy players who do that. You know, or I'm the only one who has astronomy. Let's open borders. Okay, thanks for the trade routes. But for players who aren't that weak, you can't really tell what their stat composition is. And someone who's massing chariots could be a very big problem if you're massing axes. But you don't want to just mass spears, because a lot of players do, in fact, favor axes, and you can't see. So if you're going in with a major offensive, you don't want the stack balance. But if you're on defense, then you want some balance just so you can react to anything. But it's very difficult to build enough spears to counter a dedicated mounted charge for somebody else's axes.
From episode 83 with Dan Q, the main team, Kamikaze, Heraclitus, MMC, Peach Rocks, and Q&L.
The capitulation mechanics, oh my god.
Those are horrible.
I actually know the capitulation mechanics pretty well, but they're terrible. Terrible.
Vassal states off.
I've seen them, they're truly annoying.
Just to illustrate how bad it is, let's say it spawned off a colony, so it has like a 3-city colony somewhere, and it had 10 cities. You could take 9 of its cities, kill every unit it owns, and it won't capitulate. Why? Because its power, plus its vassal's power, is greater than the average power of all civs. So even though it doesn't have a unit to its name, and you are about to wipe it off the map, we're doing fine on our own.
You know, I was thinking of repercussion number 7, and relevant to that is deciding whether you're going to vassalize or kill off a civ. Because in this case, the more civs you have existing on the map, the easier it is to get a tech, or the more the multiplier is increased. So therefore, if your focus is really on tech or getting a spaceship or something, it might just be more advantageous to vassalize if, because you're not only getting their help in tech, but you're also get multiplier.
Vassals are generally pretty terrible at teching, though. I mean,
yeah,
there are some exceptions, but for the most part, they're bad.
But the point is that it would increase the multiplier.
It doesn't tell you that the vassal diplo is averaged with yours. And the game misleads you, deliberately misleads you, into believing that the negative one you're getting for having a vassal is your only penalty for having the vassal, when in reality, if the AI hates your vassal and it's friendly with you, it's cautious and it'll declare on you. There's nothing in the game that indicates that. There's nothing documented in any of the official literature that tells you that. You're just screwed to learn it on your own.
That is so stupid. It would be so simple to fix. You could just get a +6 or -7 or something like that saying, we dislike or we like your vassal. That really sucks.
Yeah, it does.
It would be a simple fix. About vassals not teching well, maybe vassals could get additional bonus, similar to the one you get for knowing civs who know a tech, just really, really, really strengthened if the master knows a certain tech.
Hmm.
So looking at that formula, that's the modifier for techs known by other civilizations. Just divide the number of known civs who have the tech divided by number of civs who started. If you create a colony, that doesn't count multiplier. Likewise, you kill off civ, it might be actually disadvantageous to you if you're going for tech.
That's a very interesting way to see it. Never thought of it that way, but sometimes the AI is just so annoying you just want it dead. Would you really keep a single city Monty around? Just so you could tech better?
Yeah, it's true, it's true.
Yeah, because depending upon what that whatever one city was left, you'd get rid of Monty, but you'd then take over the city, and then you can build up that city, and then it can be contributing to your research. At that point, yeah, it'd just, you'd probably find it less annoying anyway, just for your own sanity.
Well, yeah, unless he's vassalized in that case. He is right. The single city, no matter how much you would build it up, it would never give you the advantage of having that additional modifier in the formula for getting the tech. But the problem is a vassalized civ will practically never get the technology you don't already have.
You don't have the tech, but you still keep the number of civs you started the game intact.
Yeah, but isn't looking at the formula, don't you only get a bonus for civs?
Oh, wait.
I mean, number of civs that know the tech divided by the total number of civs.
Uh-huh.
You could do it. You could give the vassalized Monty or Isabella all your techs, and you could research one tech, and if she has a really good city, she could research a few cheap techs for you, and that would still be advantageous. So your overall strategy, I think, is still sound.
Or if you've got a civ that has a higher tech...
Exactly, and you vassalize them.
Then you can get their techs back without wiping them out. Get a discount on those. But if you vassalize a much, much weaker civ, they're only really good for grabbing the few that you missed early on.
Comment today In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I don't really give a crap about being able to take gallons out in the ocean watching them all die, because all that does is it encourages me to hit reload, reload, reload. Okay, finally he lived. Reload, reload, reload. Okay, he finally made it to second place.
Well, that's your demon there, Jim. Nothing I can do about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do miss that aspect, although I remember it from Civ 3 rather than Civ 2. But
you're just a youngin', we know. It's okay.
We've established it.
She doesn't even know what CivNet is.
Yeah. Do you know what CivNet is, Lisa?
No.
Multiplayer expansion pack for the original Civilization. But we won't say anything more about it.
Talking about Civ 5.
The one thing that I kind of focused in on was the whole units move to Texas during combat as a base. And I don't know how that necessarily works. What do they mean by during combat? How do they know that you're at combat?
They said that it was based conceptually on Panzer General. And somebody linked up a freely accessible version of Panzer General, like 3Civ, except for Panzer General, called Panzer General Forever. And this guy has made a very good reproduction of the game. I never played the original game. But this, for about a week, I was totally hooked on it. I couldn't work my day job because I had to play that game. The way they do it, you have a choice. You can either move and then shoot, or you can shoot and then move. Most tactical war games, you have to move and then shoot, whereas Panzer General gives you the option to go the other way around, shoot and then move. That means if you have to retreat, you can shoot and then scoot back into another position. You don't have to always advance. It's not forcing you to always be the aggressor if you plan on ever attacking or holding the ground either once. So I kind of like that aspect of it. I'm hoping that makes it into Civ 5.
I never played Panzer General, period. All I could think of is actually while you were describing that, and it's totally not on the same level at all. I was thinking of Risk. At the board game.
Wow.
That game can ruin friendships, man. It really can.
I don't know. Anytime people want to bit and moan about the random number generator, and there are reasonable times to do that, it's got nothing on the frickin' roll of the dice.
Ugh. Triple ones, baby.
Yeah, random number generator is just an amateur.
Yeah, I've got CRS. Can't roll for shit.
I've always been known for awesome, nasty RNG karma.
I've got a cleaner version of that if you want to include it in the show. Can't roll for shizzle.
Oh, jeez. I don't know. That's,
editing banned. Dan made the decision.
Might be a little bit too hip or something.
Hip, man. It's getting old hat now.
Oh, come on, man. I got to make the funk here, you know?
Well, this is Nolan saying goodbye. And goodbye for myself and Daniel Quick.
Bye, all.
Lisa, QNO.
You had me at Texas.
Oh, man. Stole my line.
Mackie?
I got to get off Steam. I keep buying things.
Philip?
Join me tomorrow for my real-life demonstration of George Washington's Uncle Slam attack.
Uh-oh. And the DS?
I had a really clever line, and then you guys just kept talking, and I forgot what it was.
This is Polycast, episode 92.
I was like, oh, there's another Daniel. Too many Daniels. Anyway.
You can never have too many Daniels. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
you're fine.
Sorry, I just want to correct you. You just said, so would you buy Civilization 4 if it were on Steam? And Civilization 5.
Because it actually is.
No.
I just say, I've already done it.
Damn, yo.
Great. You said Fushizzle. Now you've got him talking like that again.
if you want to try and twist my words so that it sounds like I don't like hexes, well, I'm going to be unhappy.
Yes, I'll have your sentence. When I found out that there were hexes in the game, I was not happy. See that? Did you buy Civilization V? It was only offered out of the back of the van by some creepy guy?
No.
If it was cheap enough.
Would that creepy guy be you, Dan?
Not allowed to let your real life interfere with your civ life, man. What's wrong with you?
Record date April 10, 2010. Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.